Thank you, David, for this invitation. I'm delighted to be back again. What an incredible time we are living in. I just sort of have to start by just sort of reminding myself about that. Certainly the most extraordinary period in my lifetime, and I'm not that young. It seems like a series of cascading crises that, frankly, I'm not sure we've come to the end of. Starting with this basic context of a deteriorating ecological situation that's been accelerating, and the kind of lockdown that we've been experiencing for the last few months really hasn't addressed that at all. And then the pandemic exposing an inadequate healthcare system and an incompetent government. And that, of course, included economic partial collapse, really, exposing the truly obscene and still growing gap between rich and poor. And then now, just in the last few weeks, the killing of George Floyd and among others has just reminded us of the cancer of racism. The new situation, uncomfortable, awkward as it is, in some ways it's a good thing, because the old situation wasn't all that great for a lot of people. And one of the things that does seem to be opening up is new possibilities that seemed so frozen before. So the question for us as Buddhist practitioners, what does Buddhism have to offer that can help us understand and respond to this complex situation? I'm reminded of one of my favorite Zen stories, a very short one, where the student asked the master, what is it that awakened people are doing all the time? What's special about how they live in the world? And the answer, very short and simple, is responding appropriately. They are responding appropriately. But what does it mean in a situation like this? What is it that the Buddhist tradition can really offer us to help us here? And so what I'd like to do is focus on what I think is the most important thing that Buddhism has to offer, which is, as I see it, the Bodhisattva path, or as I prefer to say, the new Bodhisattva path, because although a lot of it is sort of traditional, I think there are some aspects that are coming to the fore or being developed in the modern world that weren't so much emphasized before. Now, the Bodhisattva path can be used in kind of a sectarian way. Mahayanists can use it to sort of say, oh, we're so much better than the Theravada people. I think that's a big mistake. I think what we need to do is look at the Bodhisattva path as offering us a new archetype. How new it is, but anyway, an archetype of how to live in the world. And it's an archetype that I think works regardless of the situation we're in, although the very special one that we're experiencing now, I think, brings the importance of this path to the forefront, right? So what I'd like to do is actually talk about three aspects of this new Bodhisattva path. The first is the emphasis that what's fundamental, what's basic to the Bodhisattva path, is that Bodhisattvas have a double practice, or a two-sided practice, like the two sides of a coin. On the one hand, they continue to work on their own awakening, on their own personal or individual transformation, but they also know that that's not sufficient. So they also go and they become engaged in the world. And I think this is really important. Notice that I said they have a double practice. You know, so often I think we have understood, so often it's understood that real practice, for example, is what's going on maybe when we're on our cushions. And to be engaged is somehow to be distracted from the real practice. And I think we're growing out of that now. We're really coming to the realization, no, that actual engagement in the world is just as important as anything that might be going on when we're sitting on our cushions. Huh? We've been taught so much to focus on our own individual sort of peace of mind or serenity or equanimity. And the danger, I think, has been a kind of attachment to that. In Zen, we sometimes talk about attachment or clinging to emptiness in a way that involves a kind of becoming indifferent to what's going on in the world. And it can also work in the other side, that I think we had last year a short weekend meditation retreat for Extinction Rebellion people and other activists, eco-activists. And, you know, these are people who are really engaged in a really difficult job, but if they lack this focus on, you know, some kind of contemplative path, some kind of practice that can help provide them some sort of equanimity as they are engaged in the world, I think, as we mostly know, this is really difficult. It's like it's so hard to avoid becoming frustrated, angry, and basically burned out. So the wonderful thing is combining these two together, the focus on our own individual transformation, such as happens when we're meditating, and the working socially for the larger collective transformation right. But it's not simply that the two things go well together. I think there's a sense, the deepest sense, in which these two practices actually require each other. And here I'm thinking, for example, of something that Franz Kafka wrote in a letter where he said, "You can hold yourself back from the sufferings of the world. That's something you are free to do. But perhaps this very holding back is the one suffering you could avoid." Let me say that again. You can hold yourself back from the sufferings of the world. That's something you can do, but perhaps this very holding back is the one suffering you could avoid, right? Because why? Because it involves aggravating or maintaining the sense of separation, the sense that my own dukkha, my own suffering, my own being, my own well-being, let's say, is separate from the well-being of other people. I know that some of you have heard me quote too much my all-time favorite quotes. Well, there's actually two of them. One of them is Thich Nhat Hanh, who said famously, "We are here to overcome the illusion of our separation." And also the Indian teacher Nisargadatta, who said that, you know, realizing that I am nothing is wisdom. Realizing that I'm everything and everyone is love, and between these two, my life flows, right? I love this because he not only emphasizes what are the two pillars of the Buddhist path, wisdom and love, or as we say, wisdom and compassion, but he shows the relationship between them so much, right? You know, love isn't an emotion or a feeling, it's something deeper than that. It's a way of living, it's a way of being in the world that integrates that realization about my non-separation from it. When we first come to Buddhist practice, I think inevitably there's a certain kind of self-preoccupation. I mean, why do we spend all this time, money sometimes, energy, effort for sore legs and backs? Well, because there's something uncomfortable. There's some dukkha, in the sense of some dissatisfaction, whether it's physical, mental pain, or just kind of existential angst about who I am and what the world is. There's something that involves a certain kind of, you know, self-preoccupation inevitably. But the interesting thing is, as we delve more deeply, as we immerse ourselves and give ourselves more deeply to the practice, what we really begin to realize is that at the core of our dukkha, our dissatisfaction, is this illusion of a separate self, the illusion that my well-being is separate from your well-being. And therefore, at a certain point, there's a kind of a tipping or an extension where we realize how important it is to become engaged. Insofar as sense of separate self is the basic problem, you know, this compassionate commitment to the well-being of other people and to the world is really an important part of the solution. I think sometimes in Buddhism, we have certain kind of mythological ideas about, you know, maybe we'll go into a cave and like Milarepa, and we'll, you know, we'll meditate and live on nettles, whatever, and we'll go really deeply into the meditation, and then we'll attain Buddhahood, and then, you know, only then we'll go out and we'll be able to be of help to somebody else. I love something Joanna Macy said. She said, you know, the world has a role to play in our awakening. I'm reminded of when I started Buddhist practice in the Maui Zendo many, many years ago. You know, we were sitting pretty intensely, and frankly, you know, moments of letting go of ourselves, openings, as we sometimes call them, insights, frankly, they weren't that difficult. They happened. But what I found personally, and I don't think it was just me, what I found more difficult was actually integrating those insights into how I actually live in the world, how I actually relate to other people. And that makes sense. Just because we have some, you know, moment of egolessness or some insight, it doesn't mean that our deeply rooted, habitual, self-preoccupied ways of thinking and feeling and acting, it doesn't mean that they automatically disappear. They're there. We have to actually work to transform them. And how is it that we do that? Well, we learn to live in a world, in the world, in a less self-preoccupied, self-centered way. And another way to say that, of course, is we become engaged. We become concerned about how other people are, how the world is, right? What that really means, of course, is that when bodhisattvas act in the world, the ones who benefit the most from that activity are the bodhisattvas themselves. Right? So that's the first thing that I think is essential to the bodhisattva path, this idea that bodhisattvas have a double practice, building on this realization that insofar as we're not separate from other people, then we have to find a way to live in the world that embodies that realization. Right? The second aspect of the bodhisattva path that stands out, and this is where I like to use the word new, is the idea that, how to say it? I think we now have a deeper understanding of dukkha, that is to say, suffering in the broadest sense, or at least a deeper understanding of what it is that can create dukkha, right? What do I mean by this? Well, when we go back to, say, traditional Buddhism, in practice, what's happened is, you know, the emphasis has been on my own individual dukkha due to my own karma, due to what I did in my past lifetime. And it's a very kind of individualized sort of thing. And, you know, if something's wrong, if there's a problem, well, don't blame anybody else. Frankly, I'm not completely sure this is what the Buddha taught. I mean, when I go back to the Pali Canon and look at the earliest recorded teachings, they suggest to me that he was a lot more progressive than the institution that formed after he died. In particular, if you look at his attitude toward women, you know, creating a bhikkhuni sangha with the realization that women have the same potential to awaken. And also his attitude toward caste, right? When you join the sangha, you lost caste. And there's a wonderful sutra, the Aganya Sutra, where, you know, people are talking about caste and how the different castes are because they're different parts of Brahma's body. And basically what he says is, no, this is, I mean, I won't go into this, but basically what he points to is that basically kingship and caste, it's a social construction. And it's not something that we should take literally. So what I think is important there is this realization that dukkha is maybe not just a matter of sort of our own individual karma, but actually that a lot of the dukkha in the world is due not simply to what the individuals themselves have done, but rather getting caught up in history, getting caught up in institutions, getting caught up in wars and so forth. I remember hearing a Buddhist teacher say, and he will remain nameless, you know, he was reflecting on how sad it was, all of those Jews in Nazi Germany who must have had really bad karma in their past lifetimes to be reborn at that time in that place. And oh my goodness, you know, that kind of attitude, I can understand where it comes from. And, you know, you can read it off from a certain kind of literal Buddhist teachings, but I think that's really unsatisfactory now, blaming the victim. I don't think we should put up with that anymore. One way I've tried to express this sometimes is that what the Buddha identified as the three poisons, which are maybe translatable as greed, ill will, delusion, right? The Buddha didn't talk about evil, but he did talk about these poisons, the idea being that when what we do is motivated by them, then it's going to cause suffering. Again, but traditionally they've been understood in individual terms. And I think in the modern world, what we can see, where we have much more powerful institutions as well as much more powerful technologies, what I think we can see is that we've institutionalized them. So I've talked about this before, but for example, I think we could look upon our economic system as institutionalized greed. If we understand greed as never enough, well, I think that's a pretty good summary of consumerism, but even more so, say, of corporate capitalism, in the sense that corporations are never profitable enough, their market share is never big enough, their stock price is never big enough, the total GNP, GDP is never big enough, and so forth. You know, creating the kinds of ecological problems that we know, because the economic system needs to grow to avoid collapse, and yet within a biosphere that doesn't grow. And inevitably, there's some tensions between them, which I think is what we're now seeing in terms of the ecological crisis. I could go on and talk about maybe our militarism or our racism as examples of institutionalized ill will, or the media, which are preoccupied with making money from advertising, selling us stuff. You could understand that as a kind of institutionalized delusion, you know, constantly encouraging us to think that the next thing we buy is going to make us happy. But I think you can see what I'm getting at here. I think this is a really important point. In some ways, I think there's been a wonderful development over the last generation or so in American Buddhism. I think it's now generally accepted that, you know, individual service, you know, maybe you and I helping homeless people, or prison dharma or hospice, I think that's now accepted as something that can be very beneficial. But the greater challenge, and I can understand why it's a challenge, is although we've become a lot better in helping to pull drowning people out of the river, we're still confronted by this huge challenge. What or who is pushing so many more drowning people upstream into the river? What's going on there? You know, and I can understand why this is hard for Buddhism, certainly in Zen, where we're constantly talking about letting go of concepts are the problem. Well, how do you move from that to talking about, social ideas, social understandings of how it is that society needs to change? And that's a real challenge, but I think it's one ultimately that we can't afford. That, to summarize the second point of view, we have this huge challenge of expanding our understanding of dukkha and therefore our understanding. I mean, what I'm taking for granted here, and maybe I should have started out by saying this, is that, you know, dukkha is the heart of the issue, right? The Buddha said, what I teach is dukkha and how to end it. And the Four Noble Truths that we're all familiar with, they're all about dukkha, right? The cause of dukkha, which is craving, the end of dukkha, which is nirvana, Noble Eightfold Path, which is how we would end dukkha. So dukkha is the issue, but the point that I'm trying to emphasize here is that traditionally, the focus in Buddhism has been to understand it on an individual level, and that's maybe why Buddhism survived. Maybe that's what it had to do to survive, to avoid getting in trouble with kings and emperors who could have squashed it if it raised sort of social questions, right? But I think we're in a situation now, frankly, where those questions cannot be avoided if we're going to be able to address in any meaningful way the kinds of cascading crises that I referred to at the beginning. So that's the second point. You know, the first one, the double path. The second one, this more expansive understanding of collective or institutionalized dukkha, that we have to find ways to address that. But it's the third one that I actually want to emphasize here, which is the fact that the Bodhisattva path doesn't really tell us what to do, unfortunately. I mean, we'd all like it if we could just go back to the Pali Canon or one of the Mahayana Sutras and it would tell us, we could just read off what to do in response to the kind of situation we're in now. And of course, as soon as I say that, it becomes obvious that, you know, I mean, the Buddha lived, what, 2,400 years ago in a very different time and place, Iron Age India. And likewise, all of the Asian Buddhist traditions, although they transformed, they're all pre-modern. None of them was facing, for example, an ecological crisis of the sort that we're facing now. So it makes sense. So what's the important thing about the Bodhisattva path is it doesn't give us specific answers, those we have to be creative about, specific responses. What it does do, though, is tell us a great deal about how to do what it is that we do, right? So in response to just thinking ecologically now, right, I mean, there's a variety of things obviously people are doing. You know, some of my friends here in the Boulder area, they're working on reducing individual carbon footprint. That's important. I have another friend, a retired banker, who's involved with lobbying Congress, you know, for citizens' climate lobby, working for a kind of carbon tax, although they don't like to call it a carbon tax. I mean, another example, I have some background in sort of civil disobedience or like anti-war work. And so some of us are interested in groups like Extinction Rebellion, nonviolent resistance. Now, which of those is an appropriate response to the kind of situations we find ourselves in now? It seems to me all of them, and no doubt many, many more are needed. But to say it again, we need to be creative in terms of the basic Buddhist context of what it is that we think we can do here. And I think it's a very individual thing. In fact, reflecting on it, I've sort of come up with a three-part meditation that I'll just mention now because I don't think we really have time to get into it. A three-part meditation to help us, you know, insofar as we feel motivated to move in this direction, to help us figure out what's the best thing for us to do. Because it is individual, I think the first part of that meditation is sort of looking at ourselves very clearly, you know, what do I bring to the situation? That is to say, considering my age, my health, my gender, my education, my skills, my network, you know, where do I come from, right? What do I have to offer? I think it can be really valuable to sort of spend some time reflecting on that. The second part of the meditation is looking at the situation, you know, where I'm at. What's the dukkha there? What is it that I might be able to respond to? For example, here in Colorado, especially on the Front Range, a very big issue, of course, is fracking. You know, we have incredibly poor air quality here, and not all, but certainly a good bit of that is due to fracking, and should we be fracking? And, you know, that seems to me one natural direction for, you know, that many people want to go in. But again, there's a variety of possibilities. It's the third part of the meditation that I think in a way is the most important. Looking at the first two is kind of preliminary in the sense of, okay, getting a sense of what I have to offer and what's needed, than to ask, okay. And it's not really a decision so much as it is sort of something that should be, I think, a product of our meditation, of sort of going deep inside ourselves and asking ourselves, you know, what tugs at my heart? What pulls me? Where does my love for the world want to go? Where does my compassion want to express itself? Again, not an ego decision, not so much a rational decision, but getting in touch with something deeper than our egos, than our usual sense of self, something, some deeper kind of motivation, right? Anyway, I'll leave it at that for the moment, but I think there can be real value in that in terms of, you know, clarifying, you know, where it is that we might want to go. Returning back, though, to the original way that the Bodhisattva path has been understood, I think there's a lot of helpful things there. Maybe it's important to highlight the fact that, you know, I mean, obviously Buddhism emphasizes nonviolence because it emphasizes respect for all life, but that's very much connected with a sort of deep Buddhist understanding of the world, right? I mean, for Buddhism, the world isn't a struggle between good and evil people. For Buddhism, the fundamental issue is more delusion versus wisdom, or ignorance versus awakening, and the realization that we're all sort of caught up in these networks of delusion. And so it's not a matter of identifying certain evil people and trying to destroy them, although, you know, in certain cases, one needs to do the best one can to stop certain types of actions that can be so destructive and so much causing so much dukkha, right? I mean, for Buddhism, it's really important to remind ourselves that the motivation for the Bodhisattva activity, it's not anger, it's not hatred. Fundamentally, it's based in love. It comes out of love. And the love there ultimately comes out of this realization of our non-duality, that we're not separate from each other, which is why my well-being isn't separate from your well-being. There's other things in Buddhism that there's so many things that could be flagged. One of them, I think, is a very sort of pragmatic, non-dogmatic approach, which goes back to what the Buddha himself said. One of my all-time favorite Buddhist stories is what he had to say when he compared his teachings, the Dharma, to a raft that we use to ferry ourselves across to the other shore, right? The other shore of nirvana or awakening. And he made the point, you know, you don't look at the raft and say, oh, that's been a wonderful raft. I'm going to carry it around on my back everywhere I go. No, the raft had a function to play. That's fantastic, right? I mean, Buddhist teachings are not revealed scripture. It's not the word of God. We don't put them on an altar and worship them. Buddhist teachings are what? Like a roadmap or a guidebook to help us go somewhere, to help us do something. And if we respect the teachings, but we don't follow them, if we don't try to use them, then it's all wasted, you know. In a way, whether we call ourselves Buddhists or not isn't really important in most cases. The question is, are we using this guidebook in a way that's transformative? So that's another, I think, important aspect of the Bodhisattva path. But what I want to finish with is what for me is the most distinctive and powerful about spiritual activism. And notice I use the word spiritual activism because certainly it's essential to the Bodhisattva path, but it's not limited to that, right? In other words, we find it in other traditions as well. What do I mean? Well, the Bodhisattva acts without attachment to the results of action. Let me say that again. Bodhisattvas act without attachment to the results. It's interesting. In one of the earliest teachings, the Buddha said that one of the characteristics of an awakened person is that their actions are nidassa, which, you know, translated different ways without expectation or even without hope. And we find many other versions, for example, in the Tibetan Lojong teachings. Quote, abandon any hope or fruition. Don't get caught up in how you will be in the future. Stay in the present. But this is found not just in Buddhism, as I said. I mean, maybe the most famous articulation of all is actually found in that most important Hindu text, the Bhagavad Gita, which talks about different paths to God, right? Right? There's bhakti yoga, jnana yoga, there's the path of devotion, the path of meditation, the path of wisdom, but also karma yoga, the path of action, right? And what does the Gita say about the path of action? Quote, your right is to the work, never to the fruits. Be neither motivated by the fruits nor inclined to give up action. But acting without intent, acting without attachment is easily misunderstood, I think, because it can be taken to mean a kind of a casual attitude, especially when you look at how much the Buddha and Buddhism emphasizes motivation, right? This was the Buddha's distinctive addition to the karma teaching. It's not just what we do, it's our motivation, our intentions. And so we could misunderstand non-attachment in a way that says, the only thing that's important is my motivation. If my motivation is pure, it doesn't matter if it has any consequences or not, which I think is catastrophically wrong. Because if that's our attitude, then, you know, nothing ever happens. It'll never bring about the kinds of changes that are necessary because it misses the basic point about what non-attachment really means. And so let me conclude by kind of unpacking what I think non-attachment to the results of our actions really means, right? Let me begin with distinguishing between a 100-meter dash and running a marathon, right? Because when you run a 100-meter dash, the only thing that's important is getting to the other end as quickly as possible. You don't have time to think about anything else. But you can't run a marathon that way, right? If you do, you're going to get burned out really, really quickly. Not that I've run a marathon, but my friends who have, you know, they all make the point. In fact, the ones that I know who have a Zen connection. And they say, to run, you know, you're running in a certain direction, but you're not thinking about the goal. Rather, you've got to really focus on the here and now. If you run in the right direction, you will eventually get there. But the idea is more just this step, just this step, just this step. And in fact, in Japanese, there's a term for that, tada, literally meaning just this. So one is approaching the goal because one is doing what's necessary right now. You're not sitting in the side of the road, you're going in the direction, but you're not so much focused on the goal. I think that's an important part of it is, and you know, obviously that applies to a lot of other things, right? Washing dishes. I mean, why do we wash dishes? Well, you know, we can wash dishes because they have to be clean. We wash dishes because we're trying to get to the TV show that's about to start. Or we can just wash dishes to wash dishes. And in a way, that non-attachment to results is the focus of the meaning of tada, right? The consequences are the same, but it has to do with a certain way of approaching the task in a more not seeing what I'm doing now as simply a means to some other ends in the future, but becoming one with what I'm doing now. And if I do that, then, you know, hey, dishes are all clean, you know. But there's two other aspects of this non-attachment to action. In the case of a marathon, you sooner or later you get to the other end, right? Even if you're a slow runner or a fast walker, right? What is it, 26 miles? You're going to get there if you're persistent. But what about a path with no end? What I'm thinking about here is what's called in Zen the Bodhisattva vows. In fact, they are recited in all Zen centers at least once a day. And the very first one says quite beautifully, you know, living beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. I vow to liberate them all. Now, if you think about that, that's absolutely amazing, because you are vowing to do something that literally can never be accomplished, right? And that might seem kind of weird, but in fact, that's the whole point of it, right? That it can't be, that vow cannot be completed is not the problem, but it's the whole basic point. What the vow is really calling for, therefore, is kind of a complete reorientation of the meaning of our lives from our usual self preoccupation, right? What's in it for me, to what can I do? How can I contribute to the well-being of everyone, right? So on a day-to-day level, you could say, what becomes important is not the unattainable goal, but the direction of our efforts, a direction that in this case has no specific endpoint. Now, I think this is really, really important, because somebody who has volunteered or taken a vow to do a job that's literally impossible, that there's no end to it, is not going to be intimidated by challenges that sometimes appear hopeless. Right? It's like, no matter what happens, we're not discouraged, or at least not for long. I mean, we're human, we are going to be discouraged, but we're going to be able to dust ourselves off and get on with it, right? Because this vow goes beyond attachment to any particular accomplishment or defeat. It's this, as I said, it's this new way of being in the world. When our efforts are successful, that's great. Time to move on to the next thing. When we're defeated, well, maybe we try again harder, or maybe it's inappropriate. But we keep going on indefinitely, right? Once we realize our non-duality with other people and with the planet, it's like we don't want to do anything else. It's like this becomes our passion and our joy. I'm reminded of Joanna Macy. I don't know if people saw this documentary called Planetary. And she has the last word in the film, and it's just wonderful, you know, because she says, you know, once you realize, you will serve this earth to your last breath. You will serve this earth to your last breath. But there's one more aspect to non-attachment to results that, you know, for me, you know, stands out as maybe the one that needs the most emphasis. And of course, all three of these ways of understanding non-attachment to results, they're all interconnected, of course. But what do I mean here? Well, let's just focus on the ecological for a moment, right? And let's be honest, it looks very difficult. I don't know if anyone else is following what's going on with this heat wave in northern Siberia. It's not good. There is the very real possibility that our efforts will be in vain, in the sense that we're close, or maybe we've even passed a number of crucial tipping points, so that civilization as we know it is likely to break down. And some people even talk about the extinction of human beings. I don't know. It's difficult, and it's difficult to anticipate. It's like we just don't know. It's interesting. In Zen, it says it's like in daily life, I think for a lot of us, not knowing can be something very enervating, in the sense of it encourages us to sort of, oh, why should I bother? But it's interesting, in Zen, we actually emphasize so much what we call don't know mind. Those of you who are familiar with Zen peacemakers, that's the first principle of the peacemakers, don't know mind, right? The other two are bearing witness to the joys and sufferings of the world. And the third one is taking actions that arise from not knowing and bearing witness. One of my Zen teachers, Robert Aiken in Hawaii, he used to say that our task isn't to clear up the mystery, but to make the mystery clear. Our task isn't clearing up the mystery, but making the mystery clear. the spiritual path isn't about, oh, now I'm understanding everything about who I am and what the world is, but letting go of ourselves, forgetting ourselves, and opening up to experience a sacred and mysterious world that we don't really understand, but you know, things are changing, whether we understand, whether we notice or not, right? And bodhisattvas access this mystery. It's like it's not something that you sort of grasp. It's rather through our practice, we open up and we are taken by it, so that bodhisattvas end up manifesting something deeper than their egos, right? For those on this path, as I'm trying to say, this awesome mystery is not debilitating, but empowering. It liberates us from dogmatism and a lot of fixed ideas about ourselves and the world. We do the best we can in response to the best of what we know, even though we don't know for sure what's happening or what's possible. And I think what's happened just in the last few months is an incredible example of that. Until this year, the examples I would use would be the collapse of the Soviet Union, how quickly communism, it seemed like overnight, something no one anticipated, and likewise, what happened with apartheid in South Africa, how quickly things can change, right? Again, very much a Buddhist principle, the emphasis on impermanence and insubstantiality. I'm reminded of something Howard Zinn wrote, quote, "There's a tendency to think that what we see in the present moment will continue. We forget how often we've been astonished by the sudden crumbling of institutions, by extraordinary changes in people's thoughts, by unexpected eruptions of rebellions against tyrannies, by the quick collapse of systems of power that seemed invincible." And I think all of us, just in the last couple months, we've seen a taste of this. I mean, the whole response to George Floyd, I'm sort of curious how much the lockdown contributed to that, but it's like it just showed us, it just something erupted there. Even though that was far from the first police killing of a black man, right? It's going on all the time, but something finally erupted this time. And I think it's the kind of thing that Howard Zinn is pointing to. You know, in retrospect, okay, we can always find a chain of causes. But if we don't know, you know, we also don't know what's possible unless we try, right? I'm not talking, and see, this gets at the heart of it for me. I'm not talking about bodhisattva activities based on a kind of optimism or even a kind of a hope, because for me, both of those are dualistic concepts, right? Optimism, pessimism, conceptually, they always go together. I'm reminded of my favorite definition of a pessimist as someone who has had to live with an optimist, right? You don't have... And think of hope and despair in the same way. If you are motivated by hope, you're going to be haunted by despair. And what the non-attachment of the bodhisattva means is something actually deeper than hope, right? Václav Havel, the former prime minister of Czech Republic, said, "Hope isn't the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something is worth doing regardless of how it turns out." He redefines hope in that way. And then Wendell Berry, "We don't have the right to ask whether we're going to succeed or not. The only question we have the right to ask is, what's the right thing to do? What does this earth require of us if we want to continue to live on it?" And for, I don't know if there's any Lord of the Rings fans here, Tolkien fans, Frodo says to Gandalf, "I wish it need not have happened in my time." "So do I," said Gandalf, "and so do all who live to see such times. But that's not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us." Yeah. But reading that, I'm also reminded of Joanna Macy, who says she wouldn't miss this time for the world. It's like, this is fantastic, right? Which is it, right? Is Gandalf right? Is Joanna Macy right? Are they both right? In any case, we are given this task to do the best we can, whether we enjoy it or not, whether we're motivated by fear or not, you know, this is our task, right? All this points to the deepest meaning of non-attachment to results. And frankly, this is, for me, the most important thing that I have to say this evening. Our task is to do the very best we can, not knowing what the consequences will be, not knowing if our efforts will make any difference whatsoever. I'm going to say it again. Our task is to do the very best we can, not knowing if anything we do is going to make any difference whatsoever. Have we already passed ecological tipping points and civilization as we know it is doomed? We don't know mind, but that's okay. Of course, we hope our efforts will bear fruit. We're strategic, we do what we can. Yet ultimately, our efforts ecologically, for example, they are our gift to the earth, gratis. They are our gift to our mother. You don't give a gift with the expectation of something in return. That's not a real gift. You give it freely. And that's what we're called upon to do the very best we can. We don't know if what we do is important, but it's really important for us to do it. As Rabbi Tarfon said, it's not your responsibility to finish the work, but you are not free to desist from it either. Interesting. The fact that it's found in another religious tradition, I think, is just a reminder. This is not just Buddhists. This is not just the Bodhisattva. This is a deeper realization about spiritual activism, what it means to engage in the world in a way that is spiritual, that's motivated by this love that I've talked about. Now, maybe it's needless to say, to act without attachment to results is very difficult, perhaps impossible, if we don't have some grounding in some kind of contemplative path. And again, that brings us back to what I said at the beginning, the importance of the double practice, because I think it's essential that we have the meditation or whatever it is our spiritual practice is. That gives us the ground, that gives us the ability to do the best we can in the world, but also to be able to let it go freely, right? And of course, to be so unattached to the results of our efforts is to set the bar very high. And maybe none of us is able to embody that double practice fully, but that's okay too. It's like, the Bodhisattva practice is a practice. Our job is not to be perfect, but to do the best we can. In a non-attached way. And frankly, I wonder if the earth today, it's not only that the earth today, I think, may be calling all of us to be ecosattvas, right? Bodhisattvas concerned responding to the ecological situation, responding appropriately as best we can, but also looking at the social challenges too. I think insofar as we really open up, get behind the ego, then something wants to emerge. Something wants to come out. And I think it's important for us to open to that and to respond to it insofar as we can appropriately. If Buddhists don't want to do that or can't do that, is Buddhism really what the world needs today? But as I've tried to say, of course, I think that this is actually essential to the best of the Buddhist tradition, which, as we know, has always historically transformed itself in order to accommodate new situations. And today, clearly, this is the greatest challenge that Buddhism has ever faced, helping us respond appropriately to what's happening. But I also think that this wonderful tradition actually can give us what we need in order to be able to face it. So let me leave it at that for the moment. Thank you.